Morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Brian Bartley. I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this case, Mr. Bunting. We thank you for having argument in this case, and I would like to address two issues today, the first being the argument that my client was deprived of a fair trial by questions asked by the prosecutor. This case, factually, the background is he was on probation on level 3 and was stopped by a level 4 probation officer for two reasons. One, that he was driving without a license, and two, he had failed to report to level 3. At that point in time, the probation officer, with help of other probation officers, discovered some drugs in the car. Almost all the witnesses in this case were probation officers. So prior to trial, there was an application by defense counsel that the issue of probation be removed from the equation of trial because probation equals conviction, and evidence of prior convictions are typically is almost always prejudicial to a defendant. The defendant moved prior to trial for a ruling. The trial court prior to trial ruled that evidence of probation would be inadmissible unless the defense opened the door somehow. The trial judge went so far as to direct that the probation officers not wear their probation uniforms. And that ruling was made the day before trial started. The next morning, but before trial started, the state then moved for re-argument on that, and they wished to have some evidence of the fact that the defendant was on probation to be brought to the jury's attention to make sense of why he was stopped. The trial court again denied the state's request that they be allowed to introduce evidence of probation in the first instance. The matter proceeded to trial. There was a mention of probation by the one police officer in this case when he identified one of the persons as being a probation officer. That was found to be not prejudicial error. However, at that point in time, the defendant did move for a mistrial. The trial judge found that neither a mistrial nor a curative instruction would be appropriate. The trial judge did, though, admonish the prosecutor at that point in time that this would probably be the only bite of the apple. As trial was developing for the state, I submit, began to feel that it had a little weakness in the case, namely that the defense was going to be disputing ownership of the bedroom where the major portion of the drugs was found, and started to want to call the former probation officer to establish a nexus between that bedroom and my client, the defendant. Throughout the trial, the judge reserved judgment on that, and at the very end of State's case, allowed the former probation officer to testify. One of the other things that the trial judge ruled is that they were not to be referred to as probation officers, but rather as law enforcement officers. And that fact heightens the error which I submit occurred in this case. Because the trial judge, in allowing the state to call the probation officer, narrowed the basis for that testimony. And that testimony was to establish ownership of the room, nexus between that room and my client. And the state was directed that the probation officers only testify as to statements and visits where there was some type of statement made by my client as to the ownership of that room. Inexplicably, within minutes of the beginning of the direct examination of the that probation officer, the prosecutor asked her how many times she had been out there. And she basically established she'd been there as a law enforcement officer between the months for about 9 months, about 2 to 3 times a month, or I submit approximately 25 times as a law enforcement officer. And I moved. Then the defense then moved for a mistrial. The fact that a law enforcement officer had been to someone's house 25 times, I submit, is prejudicial error that could not be cured. It went well beyond the trial judge's ruling. The trial judge, on the record, reminded and stated to the prosecutor that that went well beyond what I told you to do. You were to ask only how many times you had heard the statement where he admitted the room was his. However, the trial judge did not grant a mistrial and granted a curative instruction. And that's the question for this court. Is a curative instruction sufficient remedy to correct the wrong in this case. I submit it is not.
You mean by that the particular curative instruction that was given here, not
yes.
the curative instruction generally?
Not generally, but in this particular, this is a factor of the
what
case.
Specifically is inadequate about the one given here?
Well, I would submit that no curative, that I would submit that under the facts of this case, no curative instruction would be sufficient, because what went before the jury was the fact that a law enforcement officer had been to that house 25 times in the preceding 9 months. And I would submit that the trial court itself was aware that that was a potentially very prejudicial, or was a patently prejudicial fact, by her earlier rulings that, one, they would not make any references to the probationary status. And there's no way that you can issue a curative instruction that would minimize that. It's just such a fundamentally prejudicial thing.
But there's no indication why the law enforcement had been there, though.
No.
25 times. It could be for anything ranging from assaults, drugs, to a noise violation.
That's correct. So what's left is the jury has to wonder why a law enforcement officer had been to someone's house 25 times. Now, if this had been a neighbor that had been there 25 times or a co-employee that had been there 25 times, that's different than a law enforcement officer. The defense would be left with having to try somehow. The defense couldn't minimize. There's no way the defense could minimize the prejudice of a law enforcement officer coming to that house for 25 times.
Now, how many people lived at the house?
Somewhere between at least three or four or five. It was people were fluctuating in and out of there, but approximately more than three or four, maybe two or three.
The jury knew that.
The jury did know that. But this is a situation where prior to trial, the counsel for the defense, understanding the potential prejudice of probation status, made an application that was granted. And there's an admonishment to the defense counsel that the defense could open the door. And defense counsel did not conduct as rigorous of a cross-examination during trial as he had done the day before during the suppression hearing. And I would direct the court to the comment, or what happened to the state is they called the first three witnesses, and there was very little cross-examination done, and they had a recess early. And the defense counsel pointed out that, well, I'm being very circumspect in my cross-examination in light of the fact that I don't want to open the door. So we have a ruling by the trial court that's being adhered to or that's being paid attention to by the defense counsel, limiting his cross-examination, and because he does not want to have open the door. So I would submit to the court that it was a clear violation of the order. I'm not here to tell you that it was necessarily done in bad faith. But regardless of whether it was done in bad faith or not, the jury was told something which was clearly irrelevant, and this court should find that he's entitled to a new trial. With respect to the issue of, there's a second issue that was raised, and that is one of suppression. The defendant was stopped by the probation officer for two reasons. One, she knew that he didn't have a license to drive, and two, he had failed to report to level 3. That particular probation officer stopped, searched the car. Before she searched the car, she got permission from her supervisor to do that, to search the car, and she testified that she herself wasn't inclined to go back and search the residence. The defendant was then taken from the scene to the police station. He was arrested. However, she turned the matter over to the Governance Task Force, which is a partnership between police and a probation officer, for them to decide whether or not to make the search. And I would submit that is a illegal search and seizure. The trial court found the matter should not be suppressed because she found no intent to circumvent the Fourth Amendment. I submit that the proper issue is not whether there's an intent to circumvent the Fourth Amendment, but whether, in fact, it was circumvented.
We've seen some cases, Mr. Bartley, where the probationer, upon initial probationary status, signs a consent to search form, which is good throughout the period of probation. is that applicable here? Does it, if he did, A, did he, and does it make any difference to your argument if he did?
To my knowledge, he did not. If he did sign a condition to search, that would make a difference because that could be a condition of probation. But we do not have that in this record.
Now, in this record, didn't the call go to a member of the task force that was a probation officer?
That's my understanding, that it went to another member rather than going back to her supervisor who approved the first search of the car. It went to a member of another member who was not a supervisor.
Well, I understand the state's argument, even though it was a decision made or referred to the task force, and since the people involved were probation officers and basically substantially complied with the procedures, the state contends the search was all right. And I understand your response to that to be, first, there wasn't substantial compliance, but second, this wasn't in the ordinary course of supervising someone on probation.
That's correct, Your Honor. This was not in the ordinary course. They are permitted by statute to search persons on probation. The question here is whether or not this was a search of a residence, and the governor's task force also has police officers, and the real danger here is, at what point does it stop being probationary supervision and does it become law enforcement investigation? And if this particular probation officer who was supervising him wanted to go back and search the house, it would be a different argument today. But the record is that the probation officer who supervised my client did not decide herself to go back. She punted or deferred the question to the governor's task force, which is a combination of police officers and probation officers.
But there was a probation officer who was a supervisor on that task force, right?
There was a probation officer on that task force who then spoke with his supervisor, Mr. Cronin, who was not the original supervisor who approved the first search.
Why do you contend it has to be the same probation officer? I mean, if that person's involved in the search of the car and doing things with the car, but now probation is clearly involved, why couldn't they, you know, get other probation officers involved?
They certainly could get other probation officers involved, but my contention goes to that's why it's on the ordinary course of probation supervision. In other words, if she didn't say, call up and say, please go search the house for me, I'm here with them.
Well, what's the scope of ordinary supervision? If you find a probationer whose car has a lot of drugs, why shouldn't the probation officers be able to say, well, you know, we better check their house too?
Well, because the governor's task force on this record is works hand in glove with the state police to do investigate crime as well beyond just supervising probation. And our position is that there are two legally independent functions that are discrete: probation supervision, law enforcement investigation. They can also work together and collaborate. And there may not be a bright, bright line, but there has to be some line. And that line in this case was crossed because, one, the probation officer who was supervising him testified that she was not inclined to go back and search the house, that instead she just referred it to the governor's task force.
Here's where I'm confused. If we're concerned about the policy behind how this is implemented or executed, if it's the probation side, whether it's the probation officer for this particular defendant or her supervisor or someone else in the supervisory level in the probation department, whether or not assigned to the governor's task force, that makes the policy decision to search the house, why does it make any difference at all that the actual search is carried out by a police officer or a probation officer, so long as the decision to search is made in the line of the chain of command of the probation officer?
And if it's in the ordinary course of probation and supervision, that would be correct. I would agree with the court's point there, but our point is this was not in the ordinary course of probation and supervision because the probation officer who was supervising determined that to take him off the street, and it then becomes law enforcement investigation. They found some drugs. He violated his probation. And what business does probation have to go back and search more. And if probation called another group that was just probationers,
don't they have an obligation if they're going to submit a violation report to the sentencing judge to gather all the violations? So that means the drugs in the car, the drugs at the house, if there's a reasonable suspicion that there's drugs in the house, to present all that to the Superior Court?
Except when you have an organization like the Governor's Task Force, which is a partnership and a combination between the two, that decision should not be then sent to them for them to decide what to do.
But when you say them, though, we come back to I feel like a dog chasing his tail here, but the people within the task force who made the decision to follow up and search the residents were probationary people.
Well, the danger is, if the government's task force is a combination of police and probation officers, not the police officers just safeguarding probation officers, but the two of them working in cooperation, investigating crime, what protection do we have? The government's task force will not become a way to circumvent the warrant requirement.
Help me understand the distinction you seem to be making between this consent form that we've seen in other cases that probationers sign and searching during the ordinary course of probation. Aren't they one in the same, or are you talking about some plain view exception when you go to the probationer's house and you see drugs? Well, then you're not really searching. It's in plain view. It would seem that all of the searches of probationers somehow go back to this consent form.
Well, if there was a consent form, first of all, there should not even need to be a consent form to search a probationer under the statute, at least the probationer. The statute only allows you to search the probation. This is not a case where there was a consent to search the house, and there was testimony that had he been on level 4, those policies, they may have been able to search the house, but at this point he was on level 3. So
there is a distinction between and we'll see what the state's relying on as the basis for the search, but you're saying the state, if it had a signed consent, could possibly assert that as a basis. But in the absence of a signed form, then they have to follow the statute.
They have to follow the statute and or the regulations, and they have to do it substantially, which I submit in this case was not done.
Through the chain of command.
Through the chain of command, and it has to be incident to typical probation supervision. The probation officers on the governor's task force are not probation officers in the ordinary sense.
Okay, that's where I'm getting very confused. You say that this was inappropriate because it was not part of the ordinary probationer's supervision. And if I understand you, you're saying, and the reason why it wasn't is because the defendant's probation officer wasn't inclined to pursue a search of the home.
Yes.
Let's assume that the defendant's probation officer said, yeah, I think we ought to go check out the house. Would that... at that point have made it into ordinary probationary supervision?
Yes.
And then that would have been perfectly kosher, if you will. That would have been fine?
Would have been almost perfectly kosher had she then gone back to the supervisor and gotten permission, yes.
Okay. And so what happened that differentiates this case is that the probation officer said, nah, I don't think it's worth pursuing, or something like that, I'm not making that decision. I'm backing off, right?
Right, and I want to be careful. The probation officer didn't say, now I'm not doing it. The probation officer just wasn't inclined to do it, and she just referred it to the governor's task force.
Okay, so she exercised some discretion in her responsibilities and said, I choose not to do this.
Yes.
Right? Okay. But another probation officer then checked with that probation officer's supervisor and got authorization to pursue the search, right?
Yes.
So the extent to which this was done improperly is because it wasn't the original defendant's probation officer?
It's part of supervision, yes.
Okay, so is there something that specifically says somewhere that you have a probation officer, your probation officer is the only person in the Department of Probation who, you know, makes decisions about you, and therefore if anybody else does, it's improper?
No. There's not. But factually, it's a probation officer exception to the warrant requirement.
Right.
And the disconnect occurred when she was not inclined on her own to pursue searching the house.
Are you sure that she was not inclined to do it on her own rather than she was following procedure by calling her supervisor or a supervisor?
She did not call her supervisor.
Right.
She did not call another supervisor.
But she called the supervisor on the task force, right?
She referred it to the task force. The supervisor is not a task. The task force, as I understand it, is an organization of police officers and probation officers who do not supervise probationers, but who go out and round up people and check on people pursuant to tips and develop criminal investigation information.
Okay. Do you want to save the rest of your time for
rebuttal?
Please.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the State.
Without meaning to preempt you, from my perspective, the concern that I have is to what extent is the probation department or probation officers, to what extent are they enabling the police to do investigations that the police independently would not have the authority to do because of the absence of probable cause and that sort of thing, and how does that affect what happened here?
I don't believe that the that's happening, that your concern is justified. In this, the governor's task force is a partnership between probation officers and police. That's clearly been established. The reason that you need to have a partnership is that the probation officers can't proceed to search probationers or their residences unless they have backup by the police. They need security, and they need evidence custodians, and they need the police officers there in case new criminal activity is found. So it makes sense to have a partnership because the probation officers on their own would be inhibited in their investigation of probationer activity and compliance with conditions of probation if they did not have officers readily available to assist.
Well, wait a second. You're saying that a probationer on his or her own can't search anybody because they've got some procedure that you don't search somebody without a police officer there?
The probation officers are part of their procedures is to, if they are going to conduct a search of a probationer's residence, they require that they contact police to have police there as security. That's part of their standard procedure. And also they need the police to take charge of any evidence that's found in a search of a residence.
Well, we're told here that this probation officer wasn't calling the task force to get backup as she conducted a warrantless search of a probationer's home. She simply didn't want to search the probationer's home but referred it to the task force so police officers could. Is that correct or incorrect?
The evidence, the record does not show that she specifically did not want to search the residence. The record shows that she was unsure as to whether there was sufficient cause to search the residence. And there was also some testimony that it was the time of day was such that it was a shift change. There was, for the police, it was a short shift, and the officer who was present during the vehicle stop would not be available to assist her in a residence search at that time. So rather than pursue that, she referred it to the governor's task force, which is designed to do just that, searches of probationers' homes. and would have the manpower available to do it.
Who was she calling when she called the task force? Anyone in particular?
She called, there's a discrepancy in the record. She testified that she called another probation officer who was part of the governor's task force. There was some indication from Mark Lewis, who testified that he was informed that she had called the head of the governor's task force, who was a police officer. So there was a slight discrepancy there. The tendency would be that the officer knew would know whom she called. So I believe it was a probation officer attached to the governor's task force. And then that was referred through the head of the task force to Mark Lewis, who then called his supervisor, Pat Cronin. Both Mark Lewis and Pat Cronin, probation officers, had a history with this particular defendant. They had both been involved with him as a probationer in the past and were well aware of his record as a having been convicted of drug trafficking and prior weapons violations. So they were not unknown to, or rather the probationer was not unknown to them, and his history of drug use was not a new case. Regardless, the question of having a different probation officer involved, this court has found that not to be a problem. For example, in the case of McAllister, where they had a tip called into the probation office, and the direct supervisor of that particular probationer was not in the office, and a different probation officer went. That did not appear to be any problem. And there's nothing in the regulations or the statute that require the particular probation officer who is supervising to conduct any searches involved. Moreover, I'm not sure where the language "not in the ordinary course of supervision" is coming from, since the statute says that they may conduct searches of individuals in accordance with procedures while in the performance of lawful duties of their employment. Lawful duties clearly involves being on a task force. There's no indication that that is not a lawful duty of a probation officer. The state contends there's really no problem in this situation. The procedures were substantially complied with. The supervisors were involved. They okayed the search, and it was performed by probation and parole officers as required by the department procedures.
Do you agree the record does not reflect whether this probationer signed a consent to search when he initially went on probation?
That's correct. There's nothing in the record to that effect. However, the U.S. Supreme Court has, in Knights and most recently this week in Sampson, has discussed the fact that it's really a reasonableness standard under the Fourth Amendment, although whether or not they sign a consent form is salient. It's not dispositive on the question as long as it was reasonable, given probationers' limited privacy expectations. As to the other argument presented by Vince, regarding the motions for mistrial, the first motion for mistrial was made after the police officer said, I believe it was Mark Lewis, probation and parole. The remark was so quiet that the judge initially said, I didn't hear that. It was brought to the judge's attention by the prosecutor. It was not brought to the attention by defense counsel, but by the prosecutor. The judge said, I didn't hear that. At that point, defense objected and asked for a mistrial. It's unclear why defense counsel didn't object to something that he thought merited a mistrial, but waited for the prosecutor to point it out to the judge. It was a single comment. The trial judge clearly felt that the jury probably hadn't even heard the remark. If they did, it was very quiet, it was isolated, and it did not indicate particularly that the defendant was a probationer. It indicated that somebody involved in the search worked for probation and parole. Given the slight impact that may or may not have had on the jury, the trial judge clearly was correct in rejecting the motion for mistrial. As to the second event, there was a lengthy discussion about how the state could get evidence into the trial regarding the probationer's use of the bedroom, his ownership of the bedroom. In fact, that was probably the most significant part of the trial, was trying to establish, after the defense had cross-examined witnesses and raised some doubt that there might be other people using that room, the state was very concerned that they be allowed to get into evidence that that was, in fact, the probationer's room. The state had proceeded to trial knowing that the probationer had told this probation officer that that was his room. That was why they had put the monitoring box in that room, and that was why the prosecutor was frequently asking to have that witness testify, and particularly wanted to have the evidence in that the home confinement box was in that room. However, since there the judge had determined that probation and parole should be kept out of the trial, that evidence could not come in, which hampered the state's case. Then there was some discussion. Eventually, the trial judge said, all right, this witness should come in because there's been enough question raised. However, the testimony needs to be limited. At first, the judge said, well, limit it to particular times when the defendant said something that indicated it was his room, however many times that would be, when there was a positive visit, and on each particular time that happened, the witness could testify to that. After discussing those parameters with the witness, the prosecutor returned to the judge and said, my witness can't say which particular date the defendant made these statements. Could we possibly go to a time frame? And the judge agreed that would be the way to do it. So, and the judge also suggested that the prosecutor lead the witness in that. The prosecutor assumed that the witness, having been prepped, that it could that she could only talk about the times when the probationer had said these remarks, asked the question, how many times? The witness said, in total, which indicates, you can infer that the witness was confused. I've been told not to say these things. Now you want to know how many? And then obviously came out with the answer that was objectionable. And however, the prejudice in terms of the whole trial was not overly prejudicial, such that the substantial rights of the defendant were in jeopardy. The defendant had already admitted that he possessed the marijuana that was packaged for distribution that was in the car. He there was clear testimony about the drugs found, that there his personal items were in the room. There were other people residing in the house who had been incarcerated, who were drug users. So the fact that whether law enforcement had been there 3 to 5 times, which was what they had predicted early on would be the statement, or whether it was 3 times a month.
The jury knew all that about the other occupants having been incarcerated and being drug users?
That was presented to the jury, that one of them had been incarcerated. It was presented in the defense case, and that there were other, it did come out earlier, there were other residents in the home, and that there were other drug users.
So are you saying this was a rebuttal witness we're talking about now?
No, this was in the state's.
I thought I understood you to say earlier that the defendant had already admitted the drugs were his. How did that come out in the state's case?
He had a police, actually a probation officer testified that he had admitted that at the time of the car stop, that he had admitted to the drugs in the car, not in the house. And the state had presented an expert witness who testified that the drugs and the way they were packaged in the car were sufficient to show possession with intent to deliver, because they were packaged individually for sale and there were additional paraphernalia in the car. There was it was helpful that there was to that argument, however, that there was another package of marijuana as a stash at the house, but it was not necessary to find the stash at the house to conclude that there was intent to deliver from the drugs in the car. And
well, how many times was he charged with possession with intent to deliver?
Once. And the jury was given a unanimity instruction on that. The jury acquitted the defendant of the possession of cocaine charge, which demonstrates that clearly they were not influenced by any reference.
And there's the state's position in this case that the answer was inappropriate or improper given the prior rulings, but it was cured by the limiting instruction.
Yes.
Or the curative instruction.
Yes, Your Honor. So the state finds that there was an overwhelming case against this defendant, and in fact, even at the beginning when there was discussion about whether probation and parole should be allowed to be mentioned at all in the trial, the trial judge, in fact, said this is a close call, it could go either way. In order to tell a coherent story, sometimes it is, the judge didn't say this part, but at times it is important for the state to be able to set the scene, and the state had been early concerned about doing that, and the judge said, well, in this particular case, it's a close call, but we'll go with not mentioning it. So the two incidents at trial of mentions, one, the Mark Lewis probation and parole was very small, possibly not even heard by the jury. The second, there was no mention of probation or parole. However, there was the law enforcement was at the home three times a month for a period of time. Neither one of these rises to the level of manifest injustice such that substantial rights were impaired, and the state contends that the conviction should be upheld. And unless you have any.
Thank you.
Mr. Borley, what was your client's defense?
My client's defense was that there was a reasonable doubt as to who was in possession of the drugs, that we presented evidence that he actually slept in the bedroom, that room was used by many other people. The jury, in fact, found him not guilty of the cocaine found in that room. And
the reason I asked is because if that's part of his defense, then what's the harm in the jury knowing that law enforcement officers were there quite a few times over the course of 9 months?
Because what's the harm? There's a lot of harm to that. First, the state wants it in for some purpose, and there's no purpose for them to have it in other than to somehow tie my client into it. The fact that the jury then has to wonder why they were there 25 different times, guilt by association. And I just heard the state say that essentially you can uphold this conviction based on what was found in the car, and there was enough. If that was enough, the state would not have gone to all the trouble that it went to in this case to have the drugs from the house be introduced into evidence. So I would ask the court not to walk away with the thought that we admitted there was sufficient evidence for him to be found guilty of possession with intent to deliver based on the drugs that he allegedly or testified through testimony one of the probation officers admitted were his. If that was enough, there would have been perhaps two counts. They only indicted one count, and on the one count of the indictment, they merged all the drugs. So I would not like the court to. I would like the court to keep that in mind. That was a trial issue. It was very, very important. So there was no harmless error just because he was found with drugs in the car.
the curative instruction addressed, I mean, setting aside the issue of whether it was sufficient, but it addressed all of the objectionable aspects of the testimony that you're pointing to. Is that right? In other words, it was comprehensive enough, but in terms of covering the testimony that the jury was told to disregard?
I am not comfortable to say that it did or didn't. They were told to disregard it.
Are you saying that no curative instruction?
I'm saying that no curative instruction under the facts of this case would work. And even if one would work, any curative instruction would not work because, no. And certainly, as in Weddington, when a curative instruction was given, that wasn't enough. And in this case, it's so much. It's not a probation officer being there 25 times. It's a law enforcement officer being in this house 25 times. It wasn't like that they then went and developed. They were there 24 of the times for somebody else. The record is sound as far as the jury is concerned why they were, you know, there those times.
The test for evaluating whether a curative instruction will work is what? That no reasonable juror would follow it?
No, it would have to be that all reasonable jurors would follow it. And in this case, I'm finished unless there are any further questions.
Excuse me?
I'm finished unless there are any further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.